No idea he'd hurt me until he saw me cradling my arm at the sight. He checks the bones in my wrist, examines my ankle. He brings me ice wrapped in a dish towel and says that next time we're having fun, I should tell him if something is wrong. He leaves. I return to my journal. Was it really fun and games? I write. Could he not tell he was hurting me? I don't know. I just don't know. I begin to reason with myself, to doubt whether I had spoken clearly. What had I whispered, and what had I screamed? I decide that if I had asked differently, been more calm, he would have stopped. I write this until I believe it, which doesn't take long because I want to believe it. It's comforting to think the defect is mine, because that means it is under my power. I put away my journal and lie in bed, reciting this narrative as if it is a poem I've decided to learn by heart. I've nearly committed it to memory when the recitation is interrupted. Images invade my mind, of me on my back, arms pressed above my head. Then I'm back in the parking lot. I look down at my white stomach, then up at my brother. His expression is unforgettable, not anger or rage. There is no fury in it, only pleasure, unperturbed. Then a part of me understands, even as I begin to argue against it, that my humiliation was the cause of that pleasure. It was not an accident or side effect. It was the objective. This half-knowledge works in me like a kind of possession, and for a few minutes I'm taken over by it. I rise from my bed, retrieve my journal, and do something I have never done before. I write what happened. I do not use vague, shadowy language as I have done in other entries. I do not hide behind hints and suggestions. I write what I remember. There was one point when he was forcing me from the car that he had both hands pinned above my head and my shirt rose up. I asked him to let me fix it, but it was like he couldn't hear me. He just stared at it like a great big jerk. It's a good thing I'm as small as I am. If I was larger, at that moment, I would have torn him apart.
I don't know what you've done to your wrist, Dad told me the next morning, but you're no good on the crew like that. You might as well head back to Utah.
The drive to BYU was hypnotic. By the time I arrived, my memories of the previous day had blurred and faded. They were brought into focus when I checked my email. There was a message from Sean, an apology. But he'd apologized already, in my room. I had never known Sean to apologize twice. I retrieved my journal, and I wrote another entry, opposite the first, in which I revised the memory. It was a misunderstanding, I wrote. If I'd asked him to stop, he would have. But however I chose to remember it, that event would change everything. Reflecting on it now, I'm amazed by it. Not by what happened, but that I wrote what happened. That from somewhere inside that brittle shell, in that girl made vacant by the fiction of invincibility, there was a spark left. The words of the second entry would not obscure the words of the first. Both would remain, my memories set down alongside his. There was a boldness in not editing for consistency, in not ripping out either the one page or the other. To admit uncertainty is to admit to weakness, to powerlessness, and to believe in yourself despite both. It is a frailty, but in this frailty there is a strength, the conviction to live in your own mind and not in someone else's. I have often wondered if the most powerful words I wrote that night came not from anger or rage, but from doubt. I don't know. I just don't know. Not knowing for certain, but refusing to give way to those who claim certainty, was a privilege I had never allowed myself. My life was narrated for me by others. Their voices were forceful, emphatic, absolute. It had never occurred to me that my voice might be as strong as theirs.
Chapter 23. I'm from Idaho. On Sunday, a week later, a man at church asked me to dinner. I said no. It happened a second time a few days later with a different man. Again, I said no. I couldn't say yes. I didn't want either of them anywhere near me. Word reached the bishop that there was a woman in his flock who was set against marriage. His assistant approached me after the Sunday service and said I was wanted in the bishop's office. My wrist was still tender when I shook the bishop's hand. He was a middle-aged man with a round face and dark, neatly parted hair. His voice was soft like satin. He seemed to know me before I even opened my mouth. In a way, he did. Robin had told him plenty. He said I should enroll in the university counseling service so that one day I might enjoy an eternal marriage to a righteous man. He talked, and I sat, wordless as a brick. He asked about my family. I didn't answer. I had already betrayed them by failing to love them as I should. The least I could do was stay silent. "Marriage is God's plan," the bishop said. Then he stood. The meeting was over. He asked me to return the following Sunday. I said I would, but knew I wouldn't. My body felt heavy as I walked to my apartment. All my life, I had been taught that marriage was God's will, that to refuse it was a kind of sin. I was in defiance of God. And yet, I didn't want to be. I wanted children, my own family, but even as I longed for it, I knew I would never have it. I was not capable. I could not be near any man without despising myself. I had always scoffed at the word whore. It sounded guttural and outmoded even to me. But even though I silently mocked Sean for using it, I had come to identify with it. That it was old-fashioned only strengthened the association because it meant I usually only heard the word in connection with myself. Once, when I was 15, after I'd started wearing mascara and lip gloss, Sean had told Dad that he'd heard rumors about me in town, that I had a reputation. Immediately, Dad thought I was pregnant. He should never have allowed those plays in town, he screamed at Mother. Mother said I was trustworthy, modest. Sean said no teenage girl was trustworthy, and that in his experience, those who seemed pious were sometimes the worst of all. I sat on my bed, knees pressed to my chest, and listened to them shout. Was I pregnant? I wasn't sure. I considered every interaction I'd had with a boy, every glance, every touch. I walked to the mirror and raised my shirt, then ran my fingers across my abdomen, examining it inch by inch, and thought, maybe. I had never kissed a boy. I had witnessed birth, but I'd been given none of the facts of conception. While my father and brother shouted, ignorance kept me silent. I couldn't defend myself because I didn't understand the accusation. Days later, when it was confirmed that I was not pregnant, I evolved a new understanding of the word whore, one that was less about actions and more about essence. It was not that I had done something wrong, so much as that I existed in the wrong way. There was something impure in the fact of my being. It's strange how you give the people you love so much power over you, I had written in my journal. But Sean had more power over me than I could possibly have imagined. He had defined me to myself, and there's no greater power than that. I stood outside the bishop's office on a cold night in February. I didn't know what had taken me there. The bishop sat calmly behind his desk. He asked what he could do for me, and I said I didn't know. No one could give me what I wanted, because what I wanted was to be remade.
I can help, he said, but you'll need to tell me what's bothering you.
His voice was gentle, and that gentleness was cruel. I wished he would yell. If he yelled, it would make me angry, and when angry, I felt powerful. I didn't know if I could do this without feeling powerful. I cleared my throat, then talked for an hour. The bishop and I met every Sunday until spring. To me, he was a patriarch with authority over me.
but he seemed to surrender that authority the moment I passed through his door. I talked, and he listened, drawing the shame from me like a healer draws infection from a wound. When the semester ended, I told him I was going home for the summer. I was out of money. I couldn't pay rent. He looked tired when I told him that. He said, "Don't go home, Tara. The church will pay your rent." I didn't want the church's money. I'd made the decision. The bishop made me promise only one thing, that I wouldn't work for my father. My first day in Idaho, I got my old job back at Stokes. Dad scoffed, said I'd never earn enough to return to school. He was right, but the bishop had said God would provide a way, and I believed it. I spent the summer restocking shelves and walking elderly ladies to their cars. I avoided Sean. It was easy because he had a new girlfriend, Emily, and there was talk of a wedding. Sean was 28. Emily was a senior in high school. Her temperament was compliant. Sean played the same games with her he'd played with Sadie, testing his control. She never failed to follow his orders, quivering when he raised his voice, apologizing when he screamed at her. That their marriage would be manipulative and violent, I had no doubt, although those words were not mine. They had been given to me by the bishop, and I was still trying to wrest meaning from them. When the summer ended, I returned to BYU with only $2,000. On my first night back, I wrote in my journal, "I have so many bills, I can't imagine how I'm going to pay them, but God will provide either trials for growth or the means to succeed." The tone of that entry seems lofty, high-minded, but in it I detect a whiff of fatalism. Maybe I would have to leave school. That was fine. There were grocery stores in Utah. I would bag groceries, and one day I'd be manager. I was shocked out of this resignation 2 weeks into the fall semester when I awoke one night to a blinding pain in my jaw. I'd never felt anything so acute, so electrifying. I wanted to rip my jaw from my mouth just to be rid of it. I stumbled to a mirror. The source was a tooth that had been chipped many years before, but now it had fractured again, and deeply. I visited a dentist who said the tooth had been rotting for years. It would cost $1,400 to repair. I couldn't afford to pay half that and stay in school. I called home. Mother agreed to lend me the money, but Dad attached terms. I would have to work for him next summer. I didn't even consider it. I said I was finished with the junkyard, finished for life, and hung up. I tried to ignore the ache and focus on my classes, but it felt as though I were being asked to sit through a lecture while a wolf gnawed on my jaw. I'd never taken another ibuprofen since that day with Charles, but I began to swallow them like breath mints. They helped only a little. The pain was in the nerves, and it was too severe. I hadn't slept since the ache began, and I started skipping meals because chewing was unthinkable. That's when Robin told the bishop. He called me to his office on a bright afternoon. He looked at me calmly from across his desk and said, "What are we going to do about your tooth?" I tried to relax my face. "You can't go through the school year like this," he said. "But there's an easy solution. Very easy, in fact. How much does your father make?" "Not much," I said. "He's been in debt since the boys wrecked all the equipment last year."
"Excellent," he said. "I have the paperwork here for a grant. I'm sure you're eligible. And the best part is, you won't have to pay it back."
I'd heard about government grants. Dad said that to accept one was to indebt yourself to the Illuminati.
"That's how they get you," he'd said. "They give you free money, then the next thing you know, they own you."
These words echoed in my head. I'd heard other students talk about their grants, and I'd recoiled from them. I would leave school before I would allow myself to be purchased. "I don't believe in government grants," I said.
"Why not?"
I told him what my father said. He sighed and looked heavenward.
"How much will it cost to fix the tooth?"
$1,400, I said. "I'll find the money."
"The church will pay,"
he said quietly.
"I have a discretionary fund."
"That money is sacred." The bishop threw his hands in the air. We sat in silence, Then he opened his desk drawer and withdrew a checkbook. I looked at the heading. It was for his personal account. He filled out a check, to me, for $1,500.
I will not allow you to leave school over this, he said.
The check was in my hand. I was so tempted, the pain in my jaw so savage, that I must have held it for 10 seconds before passing it back. I had a job at the campus creamery, flipping burgers and scooping ice cream. I got by between paydays by neglecting overdue bills and borrowing money from Robin, so twice a month, when a few $100 went into my account, it was gone within hours. I was broke when I turned 19 at the end of September. I had given up on fixing the tooth. I knew I would never have $1,400. Besides, the pain had lessened. Either the nerve had died, or my brain had adjusted to its shocks. Still, I had other bills, so I decided to sell the only thing I had of any value, my horse, Bud. I called Sean and asked how much I could get. Sean said a mixed breed wasn't worth much, but that I could send him to auction like Grandpa's dog food horses. I imagined Bud in a meat grinder, then said, "Try to find a buyer first." A few weeks later, Sean sent me a check for a few $100s. When I called Sean and asked who he'd sold Bud to, he mumbled something vague about a guy passing through from Tooele. I was an incurious student that semester. Curiosity is a luxury reserved for the financially secure. My mind was absorbed with more immediate concerns, such as the exact balance of my bank account, who I owed how much, and whether there was anything in my room I could sell for $10 or $20. I submitted my homework and studied for my exams, but I did so out of terror, of losing my scholarship should my GPA fall a single decimal, not from real interest in my classes. In December, after my last paycheck of the month, I had $60 in my account. Rent was $110, due January 7th. I needed quick cash. I'd heard there was a clinic near the mall that paid people for plasma. A clinic sounded like a part of the medical establishment, but I reasoned that as long as they were taking things out, not putting anything in, I'd be okay. The nurse stabbed at my veins for 20 minutes, then said they were too small. I bought a tank of gas with my last $30 and drove home for Christmas. On Christmas morning, Dad gave me a rifle. I didn't take it out of the box, so I have no idea what kind. I asked Sean if he wanted to buy it off me, but Dad gathered it up and said he'd keep it safe. That was it then. There was nothing left to sell, no more childhood friends or Christmas presents. It was time to quit school and get a job. I accepted that. My brother Tony was living in Las Vegas, working as a long-haul trucker, so on Christmas Day, I called him. He said I could live with him for a few months and work at the In-N-Out Burger across the street. I hung up and was walking down the hall, wishing I'd asked Tony if he could lend me the money to get to Vegas, when a gruff voice called to me.
"Hey, Siddle Lister, come here a minute."
Sean's bedroom was filthy. Dirty clothes littered the floor, and I could see the butt of a handgun poking out from under a pile of stained t-shirts. The bookshelves strained under boxes of ammo and stacks of Louis L'Amour paperbacks. Sean was sitting on the bed, his shoulders hunched, his legs bowed outward. He looked as if he'd been holding that posture for some time, contemplating the squalor. He let out a sigh, then stood and walked toward me, lifting his right arm. I took an involuntary step back, but he had only reached into his pocket. He pulled out his wallet, opened it, and extracted a crisp $100 bill.
"Merry Christmas," he said. "You won't waste this like I will."
I believed that $100 was a sign from God. I was supposed to stay in school. I drove back to BYU and paid my rent. Then, because I knew I wouldn't be able to pay it in February, I took a second job as a domestic cleaner, driving 20 minutes north 3 days a week to scrub expensive homes in Draper. The bishop and I were still meeting every Sunday. Robin had told him that I hadn't bought my textbooks for the semester.
"This is ridiculous," he said. "Apply for the grant. You're poor. That's why these grants exist."
My opposition was beyond